Tonight, I'd like to talk about the mind, our minds. This is a central focus of Buddhism. Buddhism Buddhism is about suffering, and more importantly, the end of suffering. And of course, where we suffer is, and where we're happy is in our minds. So even if you, you stub your toe and it hurts, the pain, I mean, who knows where the pain is, but the suffering is in the mind. The suffering isn't in the toe. The suffering is in the mind. And so a lot of the Buddha's teachings focus on mind development, on getting to know our minds, recognizing what's going on, and learning how to deal with these things. The Buddha also taught a lot about our behavior, and this is really more fundamental and an important prerequisite for developing our minds. But tonight I'm going to talk more about the meditative aspect, but also developing our minds in ordinary life, day-to-day life, because these two things aren't separate. The techniques we need, what we have to do with our mind to make ourselves happy in ordinary life is the same as what we have to do to achieve success in meditation. They're not different. And a very good set of tools, which I use a lot and which is very central in the Buddha's description of meditation and of our happiness, is a group of things called the five hindrances. They're usually translated as the hindrances. The mind is a very subtle and kind of abstract kind of thing. So, our bodies are fairly kind of clear. You can kind of look at your body, know if it's ill, if it's hurting. But the mind, it's hard to get a handle on it. So it's good to have kind of guidelines or maps. And the Buddha gave lots of different ways of looking at our experience. In different situations, for different purposes, different ones at work, but also different people. So we've got these qualities of the mind, he talked about the seven enlightenment factors and the five spiritual faculties and the four powers and all the different things. And for different people, find different things work for them. For me, I've found the thinking about contemplating the five hindrances to always be very, very useful. They're mostly thought of and mostly encountered in descriptions of meditation, how to meditate. But they also, it's probably less well known that the Buddha placed a lot of emphasis on them in just everyday happiness. So from the point of view of meditation, for those of you who know about the different Buddhist terms, like the jhanas, the deep states of meditation, effectively, almost by definition, when these hindrances, which I should mention what they are, but the hindrances of desire, aversion, restlessness, dullness, and doubt, when these things are absent, then almost by definition, then the mind is either in a very, very deep state of meditation, and either in these jhanas or on the very verge of them. And conversely, so for instance, for the last 25 minutes when we were meditating, if you weren't completely blissed out and totally focused and one-pointed, completely aware of your breathing, every in-breath and out-breath for the entire 30 minutes, and I know I wasn't, then that's because the hindrances were present. And in fact, they're always present, really, in ordinary life, from when we're born, throughout our lives, in varying degrees, these things, they come together in mixtures. So to mention them again, the sensual desire is the first. The next one is aversion or ill will. And all of these hindrances, they exist in very kind of gross, strong forms and also in very, very subtle forms. So for the first one, sensual desire, in a very, very subtle form, it's just a kind of just a wanting, just a kind of slight discontent, and not entirely being content with the present moment. In its more coarse form, it's like greed or lust, very, very powerful greed or lust. Ill will can range from just being slight irritation, maybe the irritation you feel because you've got to, just before you shift your body when you're sitting here, the reason you're shifting is because there's some slight distraction, some slight uncomfortable feeling. You may not even be fully consciously aware of it, but it's there, otherwise you wouldn't be shifting. So that's aversion, that's ill will, very mild. Then you've got road rage or hate or absolute kind of anger and furious feelings. And this is also the same feeling. It's exactly the same element in the mind. It's the very same thing, but just far stronger. They're not different things. And the more you tend to develop something like ill will or, for instance, then it can get very strong. So something that starts as a very mild irritation can develop into rage. Kind of very common thing you probably experienced is maybe someone says something or something, you're reminded of something that annoyed you slightly, and you have a slight kind of irritation comes in the mind. And, oh, yeah, that happened, or they did that, or that's a bit annoying. But if you start brooding on it, within a few minutes you can be absolutely furious over something that happened a long time ago. And it just started from just a slight, just a very slight irritation, and it develops to a full-blown anger. And this is through kind of inappropriate attention, which I'll mention again later. So all of these things have different levels. So we've got sensual desire, ill will, dullness. It's usually translated as sloth and torpor for some reason. And it's one of these things that's stuck. Both those words are kind of archaic words that nobody normally uses, but it's always known as sloth and torpor. But basically dullness of mind, it means the kind of... it's very, very basically like sleepiness, but there's the difference between the actual tina mida, sloth and torpor, and being really tired. So if you don't get enough sleep, then your body is physically tired. But dullness of the mind. A lot of the time when we think we're tired, it's actually the mind is in this state and it's not really, it hasn't got a physical basis at all. But it's very, very difficult to tell apart, actually. The next one is restlessness, so agitation of mind. And the last is doubt. So they're all actually quite, they're all common, ordinary kind of feelings. They're all some things we recognize. And this is one of the reasons I think they're very useful for to looking at our meditation and also our life, our everyday lives, because we know what they are. Some of the other kind of the spiritual faculties, so the enlightenment factors, things like equanimity, tranquility, samadhi, concentration, mindfulness, can be a bit obscure. We don't really know what they are, but we all know what doubt is. We've all doubted. We all know what anger or ill will is. We all know what greed is. So they're very useful in this way. In terms of ordinary life, they're less often talked about in this terms, but the Buddha said that actually this is also what stops us being happy ordinarily. One time he was talking about how what people want in life. People want to be wealthy, be well liked and respected, have a long life, and be reborn in heavenly realms. But these things people rarely get. But in order to get these kind of things and be successful in life, he recommended developing virtue, faith, generosity, and wisdom. When he defined wisdom, he said wisdom is knowing the five hindrances, knowing when they're in your mind, knowing when they're present, recognizing them, and having the wisdom to rid yourself of them when they're there. And this is what leads to happiness in life. They're also when they're in the mind, these hindrances, they do a number of things. The first thing they do, and it makes them very insidious, is that they when the hindrances are in the mind, then the first thing they do is that they weaken your wisdom. They make us a lot more dull, a lot more stupid. And the first thing they do is that we don't know. Often we don't even know they're there. Especially think of sleepiness. I mean, if you're trying to meditate, for instance, and you're feeling really dull and sleepy, then you don't know you're dull and sleepy, because you're too dull and sleepy to realize. Also, when people are angry, people can be really angry, and it's like, oh, you're getting annoyed. I'm not annoyed! You know, this kind of thing happens. You know, if you're really feeling greedy and lusty and thing, they convince us that actually the mood of your mind is actually the right thing. So, when you're feeling annoyed, then the best thing, it seems like the best thing I can do now is go and tell them exactly what I think. You know? I remember having a conversation with someone a while ago, and they were annoyed. This woman came to the monastery. She was annoyed about someone had said something a bit nasty. And so she was telling me how she was going to write this letter and explain exactly what she thought of this other woman who also came to the monastery. And I was trying to say, well, it's probably not a good idea to write a letter. And you know, this is the kind of situation where everyone else could listen to this person could think, oh, God, no, that's the worst thing you can do. But to that person, it seems like the best thing to do. You know? Because this is what the hindrances all do, all of them have the same effect on us. They weaken our wisdom. And they make us do things which are to our harm. So description of them, the Buddha said these things, they're impurities of the mind, they weaken wisdom, they stop us from seeing what's best for our own welfare, they stop us seeing as what's best for other people's welfare, and they prevent us from seeing how to get rid of them. So they are very insidious. So the thing to do is, you know, we have to get to know them. That's the first thing, is getting to know them. So take, for instance, okay, desire, sensual desire. This is one that people tend not to think, you know, is a particularly bad thing. But if you think about it in terms of like extreme cases, when it's very strong, it's because of lust, for instance, that people have affairs, you know, with other people's partners, or, you know, if they've got their own partner. Now, when lust is in the mind, that can seem, you know, can seem like a very good idea. Then afterwards, all hell can break loose. A lot of remorse, even if nothing, you know, even if you kind of get away with it, so to speak. But it can cause, that's something that can cause enormous amount of damage. But at the time, it can seem like a very good idea. Or as like, you know, as I said, shouting at somebody who's annoyed you, shouting at the car in front or something, you know, can seem like a good idea until they get out and kind of pull a gun or something. When you're feeling dull and tired, if you're at work, you can't kind of go off and have a nap. But, if you're in meditation, we're supposed to kind of, monks in the monastery, we're supposed to meditate and stay up late meditating, get up early. When you're feeling dull and sleepy, the best thing seems, go and sleep, go and have a nap. But the thing is, the more you do it, then the more sleepy you get. I mean, I had a friend when I was at university who assured me he needed 13 hours sleep a night. And I thought he was joking at first, but then he was like, no, because I tend to only ever manage to get about 11. I'm always feeling really tired and dull, you know. And we tried to say, John, you know, that's because you're sleeping too much. Yeah, but to him it seemed, no. I don't know if he still does, actually, but you know, he can't do. He's got young kids now. But at the time, it seems sensible. You're feeling dull and tired. Even if you know, I've slept loads last night, you know, I've just had a big meal, but under the influence of this dullness, it seems like, if I just have a nap, I'll feel really good. Of course, you wake up and you're feeling really even more dull. Doubt is a good one, because that's not normally thought of. You don't normally think of this as an effect of the mind, as a quality of the mind. We think of it more as a kind of, at least I do, you used to think of it as more as a kind of a way of looking at things, or just a state, I'm in doubt because I don't know. But actually, it's an actual, like a mood as well, that comes in the mind. And it's very paralyzing. The Buddha gives some very good similes for these things. It helps us to kind of remember these hindrances. So doubt he compared to being on a long journey. Doubt is like being on a long journey. It's kind of wearisome. You're on a long journey. It's unsafe. A journey across a wilderness, you said. So you can imagine kind of the feeling being in a wilderness. You don't know when you'll make it to your destination. Of course, in the Buddha's time, you know, long journeys were much, much more, bandits and pirates and things were far more common than they are now. So it's a very kind of dangerous, uncertain kind of situation. When you're in this kind of situation, you tend to be kind of paralyzed by this feeling. And again, what tends to happen is you tend to start thinking, well, should I do this? Should I do this? Which way should I go? And this is actually, once again, is the very thing which creates more doubt. So again, I remember, we're talking about someone else again. It's not just other people who have all these hindrances. I have them too. I remember, again, fairly recently, a conversation with a monk who was, he was very much interested in science and reading a lot about science and things. And he said, this was in England, he said, oh, Ajahn Sumedho says that thinking a lot causes doubt. But I don't understand that. I don't know why. I said, well, that's doubt. And he said, no. And so he thought he could overcome his doubt by reading more, finding out more, and reading more and more and more things. And he just had more and more doubt. You know. And then he left eventually. So it's important to know what the things that bring them about are, and what are the real antidotes to these things. Restlessness, the other one. Again, when we're restless, if you say you've been very busy, for instance, now many of you will be have very busy weeks, maybe a busy day. The last thing you want to do, I find for myself anyway, when I've been, say, reading a lot or doing a lot of things active with the mind, I don't want to go and sit and close my eyes and just do nothing. It's just too boring. What you want to do is do something that's a bit more stimulating, a bit more interesting. And if you do, then what that will do is that will feed the restlessness. So when we're feeling restless, we want to do things which create restlessness. So this is the way all these hindrances work. They all persuade us to do what is actually least beneficial for us in order to overcome them. And they also tend to make us do other foolish things in life in general. So our wisdom is weaker when we've got these things. It's fairly obvious with that anger. I mean, if someone's really angry, you don't kind of ask them for their considered opinion about something when someone's really angry. But the same applies if somebody is full of desire. You don't ask someone who's got a vested interest, in something. Oh, what do you think we should do? Oh, I think you should give it to me. This applies to all of them. So these things, as I say, they apply in meditation, but they apply in life as well. So what do we do about the hindrances? So the most important thing, the first thing, is to know when they're in the mind, to know when we have them. Now, I said earlier, they're always there, and in a sense they always are, unless we're in very, 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 very deep, concentrated, powerful states of mind. But they're not always there in very coarse ways. So when you're feeling very kind of rather peaceful and calm and stuff, the hindrances are fairly weak. They'll be there, but only in their more subtle forms. But it's important to know, as our meditation develops, then we can get to recognize them even when they're very, very subtle. But it's important to know them at least when they're strong. So if you're getting, you're at work and you're getting irritated, the first thing is to actually notice that. And the more you look out for these things, then the more you will tend to notice it. Likewise, in the meditation, if you realize, there's aversion in the mind, then that's the first step, is recognizing it. That's not always so easy, because, as I said, when they're very strong, we kind of know them. But not always. I mean, when I lived in Perth before, in the monastery in Bodhinyana, 6 years ago, I spent the first range retreat here, actually I think it was my second here, with a kind of feeling that kept on coming up in my mind in my meditation. And I was thinking, what is this? And I tend to use the five hindrances to look at my meditation. They're very useful for that. So because if it's not going well, if you're trying to meditate and maybe you're putting a lot of time in, and if you just sat down after a week's work, then, you know, maybe it's not, you don't expect to get that calm. But if you're spending 3 months doing nothing else, then your mind should be calming down. And then there's various things coming up. I'm thinking, what is this feeling? My meditation's going well, my mind's bright, I'm happy. Do a bit of walking meditation, and suddenly I sit down, and it's all, this horrible feeling. And I think, well, it feels horrible, so I guess it's ill will. I guess it's aversion. Is that it feels horrible, aversion. Sensual desire, when that's in your mind, it doesn't feel horrible. You don't feel kind of miserable. You feel kind of excited. Restlessness doesn't feel quite so miserable. But this feeling was in my mind. I was thinking, okay, it's ill will. So I know the antidote for ill will. The Buddha taught all these kind of, these are the things which encourage these states. This is what brings them about. This is what makes them grow. And these are the things which denourish them, which starve them. So for ill will, the classic antidote is metta, loving kindness. So to develop the meditation on loving kindness. If you're feeling irritated, develop loving kindness. So I was doing a lot of loving kindness meditation. But it just didn't seem to work. And this feeling, usually what would happen is I'd just get fed up and sick of it and just stop and distract myself for an evening or something. And the next day kind of pull myself together, back to meditation. But the feeling would have gone. And it took me 3 months to realize that it was doubt. It was just a feeling of doubt, and I'd never recognized it before. And for me, this was a great breakthrough because, years of practicing, I'd never really come to recognize that feeling in the mind. And after that, when it came up, and there's still a lot, it happened a few times that it would come up again, and I'm thinking, what's going on? I'm feeling dull and miserable. But I've tended to recognize it far more quickly. And now when it comes up, I know what it is. It's like, okay, this is doubt. It's meditation feels hopeless, basically. I'm doing it, meditating, getting nice and calm, and then suddenly it just seems like, oh, this is hopeless. This is hopeless. That kind of feeling in the mind when you're thinking everything's hopeless, that's doubt. That's what we mean. So doubt is just an English word, but the thing that the Buddha's pointing to is this feeling of hopelessness. It's not going to work. And, I can't do it. And that's something I never thought I suffered from in meditation, because I'd had good meditation before, so I know I can do it. And I have a lot of confidence in the Buddha's teachings, so I thought I'm not someone with a lot of doubt. But there it was. So that could take months to recognize even something like that. But as time goes on, we learn to recognize these feelings in the mind. One big clue, and I found this very useful in general for all of the hindrances, is the kind of thoughts that are going around the mind. Because the feelings, the emotions, whatever emotions are in the mind, they colour our minds, and they tend to generate thoughts which reinforce those kind of feelings. And then the more we think of those thoughts, they strengthen those feelings and it goes in a kind of vicious circle. So again, like if you're annoyed, then if I was really, really, really irritated, annoyed, and the monk next to me starts shifting, I'm thinking, why can't you stay still? Supposed to be sitting quietly. Yeah, it's something which, in a different state of mind, it just doesn't matter at all. I'm not annoyed, by the way. But but any little thing, when you're in a bad mood, anything is annoying. Anything is irritating. And the thoughts that go right through your mind are things like that driver in front, or God, that guy at the desk next to me is irritating. All these kind of thoughts. And those very same things, when you're in a good mood, it's like, oh, isn't that nice? Now, the very things that would annoy you. So with the doubt, what I realized that when this was going through my mind, I think that's what I finally realized, it's doubt. What I finally realized was, I'm thinking, what is this? I don't know. What's this feeling in my mind? It's not ill will. Could it be this? Could it be that? And I suddenly realized, I don't know what's going on. Doubt. That's doubt. I'm doubting. I mean, all my thoughts were like, what's wrong with meditation? What's wrong? And actually, nothing was wrong with my meditation. This feeling came up briefly, And what I found when I learned to recognize it was that this feeling will come up, and it's not a very pleasant feeling. It's kind of like a hopeless feeling. And if I just waited, within about an hour and a half, it would just go. But the only reason it didn't go was because I started thinking, doubting thoughts. What is this? What's this feeling? You know, trying to do something about it. And then it just strengthened it, got stronger and stronger, and it would persist. So with the hindrances, the first thing, if you want to work with them, use them in meditation, but also, you know, it's very, very useful. And again, I look at my mind throughout the day, and or at least when I remember to, but when I do, I think in terms of the hindrances. Yeah. I'm a bit irritated. I'm a bit, I'm a bit kind of overexcited. So the first thing to do with them is to just learn to recognize them, to know what they actually feel like. There's the feeling in the mind, which is very difficult to spot. It's just the feeling in the mind is a very subtle thing. There's thoughts, which are easier to notice, and there's also the body. And all of these things have equivalent feelings in the body. I can't say what doubt feels like in the body. I'm not so kind of in touch with it. But like anger, it has very definite physical feelings. Restlessness, you know, our bodies feel a certain way. When we're restless, our bodies tend to be restless, and so forth. So these are all different ways of clues, of alerting us to like, this is present. Or, you know, it's particularly strong at the moment. So the first thing is, as I said, is to recognize them. The next thing then is to acknowledge, to realize that actually they are hindrances. You know, they are obstructions. They lead away from wisdom, away from liberation. When the hindrances are in the mind, it's not possible to use the mind well. Another really good simile, which I like, the Buddha gave, was comparing the mind to like gold, pure gold, and gold which has impurities in it. Is brittle. It's not wieldy and malleable. It's not so lustrous as normal. But when these impurities, these other metals, are removed, then the gold becomes very malleable, bright, lustrous. And a jeweler, whatever they want to make with this gold, they can fashion it into whatever they want. They want to make a necklace, brooches, earrings. Then they can make that gold into those things. Likewise, the mind, the Buddha said, is naturally pure. All our minds are naturally luminous, bright, alert. But they get defiled by these things from outside. It's like the hindrances. When the mind is defiled, then it's not powerful. It's dull. It's brittle, not wieldy. But when the hindrances are removed, then the mind becomes very powerful. It becomes very bright. It becomes very joyful. It's naturally happy. Happiness isn't something you have to kind of bring about. It's the natural state of the mind in the absence of the hindrances. And also it's more powerful. And when the mind is very powerful and wieldy like this, the Buddha said, then when a meditator has removed the hindrances from the mind, then whatever they want to direct their mind towards, they can direct their mind towards that. So they want to develop insight and wisdom. They want to develop psychic powers. You can do those things with your mind when the hindrances are gone. So it's important to actually realize they are hindrances, because they can, as I said, when they're present, then they tend to convince us that they're not hindrances. You know, if we're angry, then we tend to think I'm justified in feeling angry, and this is a good thing to feel. And many people actually believe that. I mean, we generally realize when the anger subsided that it wasn't such a good thing. But some people have the view that actually anger, it empowers us, or, you know, that it's a positive thing. Or greed, desire. Greed is good. I don't know how many people believe that kind of thing. But maybe not greed, but people do tend to think that sensual desires, because sensual pleasures, they're pleasurable, you know, nice food, a good book, you know, nice film, going on holidays. You know, these are sensual pleasures. Surely they're not bad. But if we think of sensual desire in terms of things like, say, an addiction, that's them. You can see more clearly that, say when you start to drink, when you're quite young, you have a drink, it's fun. Drinking is fun. It seems pretty harmless. And for many people, it doesn't get out of hand. But if any of you know any alcoholics, or if any of you are alcoholics, then you know it can be absolutely devastating. I mean, kind of horrendous devastation to people's lives. But when it starts, it seems like a pretty harmless thing. But all forms of sensual desire are actually a kind of addiction in a way. It's not always so extreme as being addicted to alcohol or cigarettes or other drugs. But with sensual desires, there's always a drawback. You get the pleasure, but when the pleasure's gone, there's the come down, the feeling that you have to have another hit. And whether that's whether it's drugs or whether it's just food or any kind of sensual desires, they all have this drawback. It's like the Buddha compared it to like a mirage or like a loan. I like the simile of a loan. It's like you get a loan, but you've got to pay it back. Or you borrow something. You borrow some fine clothes, and you think this is great, and then they say, okay, now time to give them back. So sensual pleasures all have this kind of drawback. So it's important with all of these, all the hindrances, to actually learn to recognize them, but then also acknowledge that they are not for our welfare. When they're in the mind, they're leading away from wisdom, leading away from liberation. And then the next thing to know about them is what to do about them. How do we get rid of them? So if I'm feeling dull and sleepy, okay, if going down and having a rest isn't the right thing to do, what is? And again, for all of these hindrances, there's loads of the Buddha gave loads of advice on these things actually, and there's a whole rafts of advice on different techniques for dealing with them all, which would be too boring to go into, and don't have the time anyway. But in broad outline, they all have main approaches for letting them die away. The central theme of all of them, the reason they tend to arise, is because of what we're doing with our minds, something called inappropriate attention. So we get irritated. It gets strong because maybe an irritating thought comes in the mind, or just a feeling or something. But then we focus on it, and we let it build, and it gets stronger and stronger. So that's the main reason these things get strong in the first place. So just to know that, and this is the same for all of them, lust, desire, this gets strong if we focus on things and keep focusing on them inappropriately. So maybe you might think about food. For a lot of monks, especially in the first few years, because we only eat once a day or twice a day, we do have a bit of a choice about what we eat. But anyway, for some reason or another, a lot of monks think about food a lot of the time. And if it's one thing if it comes into your mind and you just think, wonder if so-and-so is coming today. They usually bring this, that, they usually bring cake. But then you think, again, just need to drop it, and that's okay. But if you start thinking, they probably are coming today, think about it and keep thinking about it more and more and more, then, the state of the mind is going to be, this desire is going to be in the mind, which is not going to help your meditation. And be very disappointing if that person doesn't turn up as well. The thought coming into the mind is nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. These things come into the mind. But then to keep thinking about it, that's what makes it get stronger. The thought comes into the mind, and if at that point you just say to yourself, I shouldn't be thinking about the food, put it aside, then there's no real problem. And it will soon die away. So some other thought will come to the mind. But by focusing on it, it grows. And the same with irritation. Maybe you see something, it's amazing, it just needs the slightest thing. You just see, you can see a rake leaning against the wall, and that reminds you of when you were raking yesterday and the thing that person said, and you start thinking about that. And if you let yourself go, within a few minutes, you can be really annoyed, really irritated, or really annoyed that it's your turn to sweep or something like this. You know, so the more you focus on these things, then they build. So one thing is to know not to nourish them. The Buddha said that these hindrances, just as the body only exists because of nourishment, we have to feed it or else it'll die. The hindrances need nourishment. And if we don't feed them, then they just die away. So that's the first thing to know, is just that you don't feed them. So like with the doubt I was having, you know, the feeling came in the mind, and once I learnt not to feed it, it really wasn't a problem. It takes an hour and a half to go. But when I didn't know, I just kept on thinking these doubting thoughts, and it lasted for weeks. It would last for weeks. So first of all, for all of them, just knowing not to nourish them. But then there are particular antidotes to the different ones. So for, as I mentioned earlier, for ill will, if you're feeling ill will, then there's many different things you can do. But what the most well-known and thing is to develop loving-kindness meditation. So this is a specific meditation we do anyway at times. It can be used to ward off ill will arising, and it's a very good thing to develop anyway. Has many benefits, makes us happy. But this is the antidote to ill will. So if you sit down to meditate and you realize, oh, I'm annoyed, you know, I'm kind of irritated, or just a bit of, doesn't have to be very strong, but you realize it's strong enough, then okay, I'll just start doing some meditation, do some loving kindness meditation. Well, again, in everyday life, I mean, if you find you're getting annoyed or angry, then it's easy to deal with these things when they're just starting than when they've become really strong. But if you get the opportunity then, you know, if you get home from work and you realize you're really annoyed, then to do some loving kindness meditation. It all works the same way. You know, ordinary life and meditation are the same. The things we do in meditation are the things that work in ordinary life. They're not different realms. And the reason we meditate is to create wholesome attitudes in the mind. Not just to get these deep stages of meditation and so forth. It's just to be happy. So it makes sense to actually use the meditation for that. The meditation helps ordinary life. If it didn't, then for most people it wouldn't be a lot of point doing it. And likewise, if one's meditating a lot, then you have to be developing these states throughout the day. And if you're on a meditation retreat, it's not just enough to just when you're sitting to be trying to focus the mind and remove the hindrances, and then when you get up, you just let your mind wander. Then you'll never get very far. So metta meditation is an antidote for ill will. For sensual desire, then focusing on the standard antidote, if you like, to it, is focusing on the kind of foulness of the body, which is it's like a meditation theme which some people find a bit peculiar. Some relatives of mine came to the monastery when we had our opening ceremony, opening entrance to the rains, and they said, "Is that a skull up there on the table?" And I said, "Oh yeah, the last guy left it there." You know, is it real? You know, is it someone's? You know, where did it come from? I don't know, but it looks a bit odd. But it's like most religious traditions; they will have this. You know, the Christians meditate on death and so forth. These things, they're not just for the sake of being miserable. They're specifically for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons for say looking at a skull and looking at that, or thinking about the body, and thinking about the, yeah, the reality of the body, which is, there's not just what it looks like on the outside, but all the kind of gunge and all the stuff on the inside. It works not just for lust. I mean, it does counter lust. If you're feeling very lustful, and again, for a monk, this is a problem because, you know, we can't do anything about the lust. But even for layperson, I mean, if you're feeling lusty, I mean, it's perfectly legitimate to, you know, to indulge in it. But say, if you're trying to meditate, if you're on a meditation retreat, you don't want to be indulging in it. Then thinking of the foul aspects of the body, just not so much foul, but just the unattractive aspects of the body, you know, the kind of the things that are in the inside, it makes it fade away. But it also works for even just a general desire or discontent. If you're feeling a bit kind of like, for food, even desire for food, if you think about the unattractive aspects of the body, that tends to die away. Because it's all the same feeling. So the sensual desire is just sensual desire. So For dullness, there's a whole, you know, there's lots of different techniques for dealing with dullness. Opening your eyes, as I suggested during the meditation, looking at lights, imagining light if it isn't there, getting up, doing walking meditation. We do walking meditation in the monasteries a lot. Chanting, reciting things. There's lots of different techniques. So all of these things, there's the book, there's the things you find in the books, the antidotes you find in the books, and they're very, very useful. But there's also knowing your own mind. And really, that's the most important thing. So, for instance, recognizing that you can read about, okay, there's sensual desire, ill will, dullness, restlessness, and doubt. But there's no good just knowing those words. You have to know what they feel like. And like I said, for me, I didn't recognize what doubt felt like for a long, long time. So just as you have to recognize them in your own mind, also you have to know what works in your own mind to get rid of them. So you try certain things, and some things work better for some people than for others. again, the Buddha said that somebody who meditates would just try and do it on by rote. She's like a cook who doesn't really pay attention. Like a king has a cook. And the cook just puts the ingredients in, serves the dishes up, and doesn't really pay much attention. But a good cook will be watching, and thinking, "Oh, okay, you know, he seems to like that kind of thing. If I put these spices in the soup, maybe he'll like that." So he puts a bit of ginger in, puts a bit of this in, and they know, okay, he doesn't like that, so maybe this will work. And they pay attention. And this is so a good cook like that would be is like a good meditator. You don't just do it by rote. You watch your mind. You see what the results are. And maybe you're given advice to try this, try that. If you try it and it just doesn't work, then okay, maybe that just doesn't work for you. Maybe something else works for you. So it's a skill that you have to develop, and it takes time. The basic, for restlessness, the basic kind of standard antidote is just calming the mind, which seems kind of obvious, really. So if you're very restless, then to put the focus on calming the mind, in other words, meditating. Elsewhere, the Buddha gave a lot of good advice about when the mind is very restless. The last thing you want to do is just sit down and meditate. Buddha once compared it to like someone who's running. If you're running fast, and rather than try to stop dead, to think, okay, well, I'm running, why don't I just walk instead? And then after walking, thinking, well, instead of walking, why don't I just stand still? And then from standing still, I think, well, I could just sit down. And then from sitting down, thinking, well, why don't I lie down? So each more coarse activity is replaced by something just slightly more subtle. But rather than going from running full tilt to lying down, it's just from running to walking is an easier step to make. So if the mind is very, very restless and very active, I find that rather than thinking, I'll just go and sit now and just try to watch my breath, and just your mind will be all over the place and it doesn't really work. So what you could try is doing something a bit calmer than whatever you've been doing. Not something that will agitate your mind more, which you may want to do. Oh, let's read something, watch a film, or do something like this. But something a bit calm, like gardening or something, or something fairly meditative, but something still active, or walking meditation, a very good thing we do in the monastery, or something like Tai Chi or Qigong or something that's meditative but still active. And then, or chanting, or if you like chanting, things that kind of bring the mind to a calmer state. And then when you've done that for a while, maybe then you can do something, you know, calmer, you know, so just walking meditation. And then from that, maybe then sitting. But if when you're sitting in meditation, the mind's still very active, then you can just, rather than just trying to just watch the breath and just do nothing else, then maybe give it something to do. Okay, counting the breaths. You know, this is a bit more active, gives your mind something to play with. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you just got to try different things out, basically. So it all takes time and skill and practice and experimentation. For doubt, I mean, for me, just knowing it really is the main thing, and just not feeding it. There are things we can do like say with the practice, if you're a meditator and you have doubt about the practice, doubt about what to do, then knowing in advance, you know, if you're being familiar with what you're doing and what you should be doing, is something that could not so much overcome it at the time, because you know, when doubt arises and kind of sitting and reading books and trying to find the answer to your meditation in books, it tends not to work. But knowing in advance, but mostly I find that with that it's just learning not to feed it really, just learning to recognize it and then not to just, you know, think these thoughts and develop, you know, try to figure it all out. When these things are completely gone, then it's, as I said, the Buddha mentioned these similes. It's like being on a long journey was the simile he gave for doubt, or the sensual desire the Buddha compared to. What did he compare it to? Okay, I'll go on to the second one. Maybe I can't remember what the first one was. But being in slavery, being in prison, being on a long journey, ill will he compared to being ill. Having anger is like being ill, being sick. Sensual desire compared to being in debt, actually. So if you imagine you've been in debt, you've taken out a loan for your business. When you pay off that debt, the feeling of relief afterwards. This is like the fading away of sensual desire. If you've been ill, been sick, and then you recover from that sickness, this is what it feels like when ill will has disappeared. If you're been in prison and then you're freed, this is what it feels like when tiredness, sloth and torpor have disappeared. These similes are very useful for kind of fixing these things in the mind, kind of images like this tend to be easier to remember than just kind of abstract concepts. And restlessness is like being a slave. And again, so imagine you've been a slave and then you're freed from slavery. So that feeling of release. So they're quite, if you think about it, they're quite strong similes. The Buddha said, so when a meditator has actually finally got rid of these things, and one is on the verge of very deep meditation, it's like being freed from prison, released from slavery, you know, free of debt, and recovering from an illness, and arriving safely at your destination. And until you have reached that stage, then it's like being on a long journey in prison, you know, suffering from illness and so forth. So these things, I think the Buddha was doing, making it like this, giving those similes, to show that these things are very, very, very much worth dealing with, very important to deal with them, if we're serious about our meditation. But as I said, also, just in life, you know, if you want to be happy, then do you want to know what's good for you? You want to be able to make sensible decisions, then you know, you also need to be able to deal with these hindrances. In terms of, I wanted to talk about the kind of the more practical aspects as well, but haven't so much talked about them. But a very common thing people say when talk about meditation, people say, "Oh, yeah, I'd like to, you know, I really should must come to the monastery sometime, or I really must go on a retreat sometime." And this is people who never do, and there's the kind of feeling that, you know, I'd love to do this, but I've got so many things pressing on me. But it's our minds work so much better when they're free of the hindrances, when we've been meditating. If you meditate, it's like, it's a very common thing. People say, you've got a decision to make. So people say, oh, sleep on it. You know, go and sleep on it. And then tomorrow, you know, things will look different. And it's very often works. You know, the next day, you think about the thing, and it's a lot more obvious what to do. And I think part of that is not having a rested mind helps. But I think also, it's just that if you take your mind off of the turmoil in the mind, then the whatever hindrances that are there in the mind, they're allowed to subside. If you just put your mind on something else, they'll tend to subside. And the things which are obscuring our wisdom will tend to die down. It's just, even ordinary things, but this isn't just in terms of deep meditation, once somebody came to the Buddha and asked him, this is a Brahmin, and they do all these ritual chanting. He asked the Buddha, why is it sometimes it's really easy to remember the chants, even when I haven't practiced them for a long time, and they just come to mind just immediately. And other times, I just can't remember anything. What's the difference? And the Buddha said the difference there is if the hindrances are present in the mind. When the five hindrances are in the mind, then you can't remember the chanting. Things don't come to your mind. The mind doesn't work very well. When they're absent, the mind does work very well. And this is anything we do, anything you want to do with your mind. And often you think, we use our minds a lot. So if, when you're at work, if you're interacting with other people, if the hindrances are there, then you'll be less acting less efficiently. So if you want to get things done, then if you meditate more, if you put some time aside for meditation, then everything else you do in your life will be more efficient. I mean, I'm not just speaking from theory. I mean, this is what I've found to be the case. If you actually think, I know I need to do this, it's really pressing, but I will take the time to just calm my mind and meditate first. And then you go to do these other things, and suddenly it's a lot easier and it's a lot clearer what it has to be done. One example, you probably heard it, but Ajahn Brahm's story about when he was a student. But I thought it was very interesting that he, when he was doing his final exams, he'd learnt to meditate by then, and he was quite a good meditator already. And when he had the exams, they had morning and afternoon exams. In the mornings, he'd have a three-hour exam, and then rather than going and chatting or trying to kind of think about, how did I do, or just even having lunch, he would go back. He only had an hour, I think he said. He would go and meditate. He'd walk back to his room, meditate for 20 minutes, and he was able to actually make his mind quite calm quite quickly, and then go back. And at the end of the morning, he said he was completely jangled and his nerves were frayed after 3 hours. I mean, what it's like being in a three-hour exam. After 20 minutes of meditation, he was calm and peaceful again. And then he could do the next exam. And then the next day, he would start again. And then every day for 5 days, he did this. And he did very well in exams. And I think that's probably had a lot to do with it. So it is a very practical thing, how to do your exams well, how to make proper, sensible decisions instead of foolish decisions. We all know that we make stupid decisions when we're tired or if we're irritable and so on and so forth. So these hindrances, they're there for ordinary life, for everyday life, as well as just thinking about them, using them as tools. They're for everyday life as well as just for meditation. Perhaps, I don't know what the time is, but perhaps I'll stop there. And if anyone has any questions about what I've said or anything they'd like clarifying, please ask. Yes? Yeah? They tend to, yes. But what I was referring to is the fact that when a mood is in the mind, then it tends to, there's thoughts are in the mind, but that's not all there is to the mind. There's the emotions and the general feelings. So anger or ill will is kind of mood. And what tends to happen is that when that mood is in the mind, then thoughts are being generated almost all the time. It's very, we're constantly thinking, even if we've got nothing to think about. And even if there's no hindrances driving the thought, there's just a general restlessness. There's just gibberish going on in the back of your mind, which you find when you start to meditate. If you've got ill will in the mind, then it will tend to generate irritated thoughts. You'll remember things that annoyed you. You won't tend to remember things that are very, very pleasant. Other things that happen will generate irritated responses. These thoughts themselves generate the feeling of ill will. So even if there isn't ill will in the mind to begin with, if you can do it, it's not advisable with ill will, but if you just start thinking irritating thoughts, purposefully, you can try it, try it at home, purposely think some irritated thoughts and do that for a minute, you'll find yourself a bit miserable and depressed after a minute of doing this. You're generating, those thoughts generate that kind of feeling. So for instance, if you're talking, this is something that's very common, if you're talking with somebody, and you're slagging someone else off or something like this. This is a very common thing. It's a very, very insidious thing to do, because you can actually be quite cheerful and happy, and you, you know, maybe you're at work moaning about the boss or something. Within a short while, you'll be fed up and miserable. You're making yourself more miserable. You may have started just doing it just to, maybe to bond or to be pally, but actually you're putting yourself in a bad state of mind. But those bad states of mind also generate those feelings, so it does work in a loop like that. And so for the other hindrances too. So they do tend to feed themselves like that. With those other things. You know, any state, if you've got feelings of loving kindness in the mind, if you've got a general feeling of love and you know, then you look at other people and you think, oh, man, what a nice person. I hope they're well. You know, kind of you want those, and those kind of thoughts will come in the mind and they will tend to feed that feeling. Yeah. So, I mean, the Buddha put it very succinctly. He said, whatever a person thinks about and ponds on for a long time, that becomes the inclination of the mind, that becomes the habit. Every time you think a thought of ill will, then you've abandoned the thought of love to develop the thought of ill will, and in future your mind will incline to thoughts of ill will more often. And conversely, every time you think a thought of love, then you've abandoned the ill will to develop love, and your mind will incline that way. Which is why it's very important to keep track of our thought, to keep track of our minds, to be aware of what's happening. And when we do realize, then to say, no, I'm not going to indulge in this. Although it feels maybe good to indulge, I won't. Because the more I indulge, the more this will happen in the future. Yes, please. Right. Yeah, that's a good question. It's something I struggled with for a long time, actually. Am I supposed to do something about it? Am I supposed to just watch it? Trying to figure it out isn't the best thing. In terms of, you know, work it out with the mind. If it's very subtle, if it's just a kind of just slight irritation, it can be enough to recognize it. And the power of mindfulness itself is enough to dissipate it. So if there's just, you suddenly notice, I'm feeling a bit irritated. And then, I mean, the more you become aware of your mind, if you look to think, well, yeah, why is that irritation there? It's worth wondering, why is it there? And you might find some little thing sparks it off. And you realize that the feeling of irritation is completely out of proportion to what it was. And you can just let it go and kind of fade away. But if it's very strong, then it tends not to be enough, because it's very difficult to keep the mind off of these thoughts that feed that feeling. So, for instance, you can be, say, angry and thinking, okay, there's anger in the mind, okay, I'm aware of it now, I'm not going to feed this. But if it's very strong, it's very difficult then to keep the mind from just not going back to this irritating thoughts. If you find you can't do that, then it's good to do something else to counteract it. Again, the Buddha gave lots of different advice for different ways of dealing with, you know, distracting thoughts and things. And the first piece of advice is just ignore it. Just like, so if there's something you don't want to see, you just look the other way, and then you wouldn't see it. So with those thoughts, those feelings. But sometimes that doesn't work. And so, well, if that doesn't work, then try replacing it with something else. Just like you would knock a peg out with another peg. You can knock a peg in wood. You can use something else to get rid of it. So that's the kind of like the antidote method. So, you know, you're feeling ill will, okay, develop loving kindness. And then the example about if you're running too fast, and then just try to slow the thoughts down, slow them down. That was another example he gave. So you have to see at different times, different things work. So if you can, just by watching it, just being aware of it, it fades away, then that's good. But if it doesn't work, then you have to do something else, try different things. Okay. Anyone else? Don't be shy.
Do we accumulate all these things
Sorry, could you speak up a bit?
Oh, sorry.
Yes, okay, I'm there. Right. Yes. It will. Our habits. They. Again, the Buddha said they harden into personality. The more we do think things, then our actions become habitual, and that they develop our character, and that hardens into personality. So we do tend to become more rigid as we get older. Yeah, but when you're young, you have hindrances too, actually. And I mean, 3-year-old kids are awful. You know, I was awful when I was a 3-year-old kid. So, but we tend to be able to indulge ourselves a lot more when we're younger, and with a lot more free, a lot less constraints on us. So we tend not to come up against them so much. But it is true that, like as I mentioned earlier, the more if we habitually think in certain ways, then that becomes our habit. So it's very important. I mean, depression, for instance, this comes up, it can be, once you get into this state, you can get into a loop, and then you tend to have more depressed thoughts and so on and so forth, and it's a vicious circle. But then you have to kind of start bringing yourself out of it. So people who habitually are, very friendly, sunny dispositions, and like other people, become sweeter and sweeter and more loving, lovely people as they get older. Whereas crabby, miserable people get crabbier and more miserable as they get older. So that just shows that it's very important to deal with our minds. You can't just leave it to go. I mean, your body, your body's falling apart. Well, mine is going to pot. And you kind of think, oh, I really should look after myself, eat healthily, exercise. Yeah. And we know that if we don't, we're going to regret it later. But we usually do nothing about it. But the mind is the same. I mean, if you don't do something about it, it'll just get worse. Yeah. Or, at the very least, it won't get any better. But you can see how what you're pointing to is very important. So our bad habits, they will get worse. But the good thing is that no matter what habits you have, there is no unwholesome aspects of your personality or life that cannot be developed and cannot be completely eradicated. And the Buddha just says that our minds naturally are pure, bright, luminous. These things come from without, from outside, and just as you can remove the dross from molten gold, so you can remove the hindrances from your mind. And I find that a very good way of looking at meditation. Rather than trying to develop something, trying to get some kind of something in meditation, it's just removing the hindrances. There's a phrase that the Buddha used, just talking about staying, developing wakefulness, and he describes it as the monk stays up late, walking and sitting, removing. Ridding his mind of obstructive states, and then he kind of goes to sleep. And when he wakes up, as soon as he wakes up, he gets up again, and he's just sitting and walking, removing his mind of obstructive states. And there's something about that which I find inspiring. It's just that's all we're doing. We're just kind of, these states come up in our mind, we see them, we just remove them, just remove them. Just like taking the dross away from the molten metal. And just keep removing them, keep removing them. And if you keep doing this, then you'll end up with a very bright mind. So, it is important to keep working on it, but it can be done. Yes, that's another great simile, actually. Yeah, weeding the garden. Yeah, if you've got a plant or a tree, if you simply water it and weed around it, then that's all you have to do, and eventually it will flourish. Yes, someone at the back. I didn't quite hear the end of that. If you've got strong sensual desire, and if you cut it off suddenly, did you say? Right.
You know, all indulgence leads to suffering. No? Yeah, that's the true thing here. But for, I mean, in your speech, okay?
Yeah.
For a newcomer, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you don't try to do everything at once.
So, interact with ourselves, see how much we can follow the teaching, or what level we're prepared to start.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, again, that's why I think the image of just removing impurities is quite good, because it's not like it's not all at once. It's just like you see something unwholesome arise, and then you remove it. Also, you see for yourself, you know, is this leading to my harm? But you have to be very honest, and it's quite difficult. As I say, when the hindrances are present, then you tend not to realize that they are for your harm. But as time goes on, so with things like, say, sensual desire, at first maybe you realize, okay, kind of picking out is not good for me. But, you know, or it's like getting absolutely blotto, you know, and kind of waking up the next day and thinking, oh my God, what did I say? Isn't good, but the odd drink is okay. And maybe that's enough. Maybe that's all as far as you want to go, just to kind of drink socially, but you know, don't give it up altogether. But then as time goes on, you might find that actually, you know, the less I drink, the better I am. You just take it as far as you want to go. I got a friend who was asking me about the Buddhist precepts about not killing. And he finds it, you know, easy enough not to go around murdering people. But when it comes to like ants and insects and things, he says, oh, yeah, what do I do about this? You know, I just kind of can't take that so seriously. So my advice was just to just work in that direction. You know, because if you're, say, completely, yeah, don't care at all about animals and think, you know, it's our right to just kind of hunt, kill any animals, it really doesn't matter, they don't feel anything anyway, then the idea of taking care not to step on an ant seems utterly ludicrous and laughable. But as you get more compassionate and tend to be kinder to the people around you, kinder to animals, then things that previously you thought was too extreme, you realize, well, that's not so extreme at all, actually. I could take that extra step. And before you know it, you know, what you consider to be too much effort changes. So eventually you just, I'll become a monk or nun, and you know, you leave. I mean, when I first heard a monk, it was Ajahn Brahm, actually, he was in London, he was giving a talk, and I was going to learn about meditation, he said, he was hammering on about, we need more monks, we need more monks. And I certainly didn't want to be a monk. I remember thinking, yeah, don't look at me, mate, you know, sort of like. And yet within 3 years, I thought, actually, yeah, I've had enough of all this. I'm not suggesting you all, you know, become monastics, but, you know, we take a step in a certain direction, and then you realize, well, actually, no, I can take another step, and, you know, and, oh, maybe another step. So all of our practice, developing our morality, you know, developing our meditation, all of these things, you take a step in a direction, and you find another step isn't as difficult as you thought it was to begin with. But yes, but there is a danger that people can try to be too forceful and strong, and I'm just going to give up everything, and then they're utterly miserable. That's not such a good idea. Yeah?
It seems that the core of the ignorance is sort of unconsciousness and being habitual and just like happens to us. I was wondering what I've really said before that, trying to make yourself angry.
Yeah, well, it's not such a good idea, actually.
Well,
but
would it be effective to actually just make a conscious decision to do a hindrance and to do it from the beginning, consciously decide it and be there from the very beginning and leave it at and learn that way rather than always having reactive and coming on and waiting
right.
And watching and feeling bad and moving.
Okay. I don't know if you heard the question, but purposely bringing these hindrances on in order to, you know, to experiment with them, get to know them, it's not really necessary because they're always coming. Just learning to be more aware of them is actually probably a better idea, because the more aware of your mind you become, you realize actually you don't have to wait very long at all for the next hindrance to come up. Actually, it's happening all the time. Just the more you become aware, then the more you realize that happens. So there's plenty of opportunity for recognizing them. It probably wouldn't work doing it that kind of way because it's too kind of artificial and, I don't know. I personally, you could try it, but I wouldn't recommend trying to bring them on. These things come anyway, especially if you're trying to meditate. You go on a meditation retreat or something, you find that, getting rid of the hindrances is extremely difficult, so there's always something there. And one of the things to learn when you can't see anything very strong is to learn, okay, I don't seem to have any of the hindrances. I'm not angry, I'm not really lusty, I'm not really that dull, I'm quite wide awake, I'm not restless. So why can't I meditate? So because they are, those things are there, but you just haven't recognized them. So that's that level. They're easy to see. They're fairly easy to see at a strong level, which is what you would generate if you were to bring them on purposefully. But at the subtle level, it's actually very difficult to recognize. And so even things like dullness, I mean, you can think you're perfectly bright and wide awake, but it's only when those things are gone, when you meditate and suddenly your mind becomes suddenly far brighter, and you realize, my God, I was really dull, and I thought I was really bright. Yeah, so those things can't be seen by in the very coarse ways. Do you know what I mean? What I'm getting at? Yeah, doubt. That's doubting. Okay.
It's awareness you're speaking of. Mindfulness, awareness.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's very, very mindfulness is very important. Of course, none of this is possible unless we're actually aware of what's going on, and that's very difficult. But we can only develop it by practice. But when we become more aware of our minds, then we can really start working with it more. But obviously, if you're not even aware you're angry, then how can you do anything about it?